everybody. My name's Katie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Katie.
And thank you all for having me tonight. I am really grateful to be sober today. And thanks to my friend Lydia for driving out here with me. My sobriety date is January 17, 2001, and I have a sponsor and a home group. And those things have been kind of like the pillars of my sobriety. My first day at my first meeting, everyone said, "You got to get a sponsor. You got to get a sponsor. You got to get a home group." And I did, you know. And somehow, one day at a time, you know, I've been able to stay sober, and I'm really grateful for that. My sponsor, you know, I can be honest with her. She helps give me direction and shares her experience, helps keep me accountable. And my home group, you know, people know me. I have service there. They look out for me. And it's a place where I've grown up and learned my foundation and the principles of AA. And my sobriety date, it's just my experience. I've been sober since my first meeting. And I hope I never have to change my sobriety date. But, so I really hang on to it. And so for me, I haven't told my story in a little while. So I felt kind of nervous, but I prayed, and I'm just going to try to be as honest as possible and hopefully not put anyone to sleep and just do my best. So for me, I started drinking at a really young age. I grew up in a home with a lot of partying, a lot of drinking, a lot of chaos. So my family, I mean, they're not necessarily alcoholics. I don't know, but my parents have been pretty hard drinkers most of my life, and I grew up going to bars and just being around a lot of craziness. So as far back as I can remember, I've had alcohol in my life. I used to think it was like a magic potion, like, you know, it seemed to change everyone. They seemed to be happier and more fun and loose. And also, though, I saw, you know, my father would get into a lot of bar fights. You know, there was some violence going on in my home when he was drunk. So I just grew up being really aware of alcohol from as far back as I can remember. You know, there's, like, family stories of me, like, I was choking on a Goldfish cracker when I was, like, 2 years old, and they gave me a beer to wash it down because there was nothing else nearby. And I just, like, chugged the whole thing and then had this, like, big smile on my face, you know. And so that was, like, a story my family would tell. But, I mean, obviously, I don't. Like, for me, I don't remember my first drink exactly because of things like that, you know, like, but, you know, growing up, my older sister, we just learned to sneak alcohol at family parties and, you know, pour ourselves drinks, whatever. And as far back as I can remember, too, like, I just had this great need for attention. I had to be treated extra special just to feel okay, and if you treated me average or normal, I would be like, oh no, like just totally upset about that. Like, I always had to be the center of attention. I always needed more, 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 an excess of everything. So when I started going to school, I was kind of this like overachiever, always had to be the best and played a lot of sports, was really involved in school, and just, you know, everyone was like, you have so much potential, and I was doing well, but, like, I was really sensitive and fearful a lot, and so really when I discovered drinking, I just remember feeling, like, relief, because I'd spent so much time trying to seek the approval of my parents and everyone around me that finally I could just, like, breathe, you know, and alcohol gave that to me from as far back, you know, like, ever since I started, and so as I got older, I just naturally started to kind of turn my attention away from scholastic achievements and really liked being bad. I mean, I hated getting caught, but I loved breaking the rules and being bad. And I was smoking cigarettes and sneaking out with boys when I was 12 and running around. And I just remember, though, like when I was 13, I started getting really depressed. I had been playing on like a nationally ranked softball team, and I blew out my shoulder. And at that point, I just thought, like, I'm going to be a professional athlete. This is my life. And when I hurt my shoulder really bad, I just felt like my life was over. And I also started having to take a lot of, like, prescription pain pills for my shoulder. And, you know, that was prescribed and everything, but I would save them up and just take them with alcohol. And I didn't run that by anyone. I don't even know why I thought to do that. But that was just my natural instinct, you know. And so just some weird things like that. And as I got older, I changed schools. And there were a lot of kids from, like, the wrong side of the tracks or whatever. And, you know, I still wanted to be good, though. And this guy, he got into a fight in the hallway and accidentally, like, slammed me into a locker. And I seriously vividly remember hitting the locker and being like, I'm in love, you know. And, like, this guy just seemed like the most dangerous, like, coolest guy in school. And, of course, I was just like, he's my new obsession, you know. And so his friends and everybody, you know, they were drinking all the time and partying and running from the cops and all this crazy stuff. And so I started hanging out with them all the time and tried to change my image. And, you know, alcoholics, like, I've heard people say, like, being a chameleon. And really, like, what it's been for me is just, like, I'll be anything I think you want me to be. Like, I'm so fearful and self-centered and scared that, like, I don't know who I am or what I like. I just want you to like me, you know. So I will do anything for that. And so I started hanging out with these guys and, you know, stopped going to school. And, you know, the bright outlook that I had built for my life just slowly started to get worse and worse and worse. And I got a job at a bar with my older sister. Around that time, my sister was getting really big into drinking and drugs. She was going to Virginia Tech. And I started just, like, following in her footsteps. Like, I've heard the term, like, drinking sponsor. Like, my sister taught me the ways of the street, like, how to get things, like, how to drink, you know, because I was still so young. And that's, like, the crazy thing about my story is, like, all of this happened when I was so young. But also another thing that I just want to point out is, like, the story of my alcoholism doesn't end on my sobriety date. The story of my alcoholism continues up into including today because I'm an alcoholic just as much, if not more, than I was when I was drinking. And so I've had adventures before and after. I've had struggles through sobriety. So it's not just like, oh, my sobriety date and my alcoholism stops, you know. Like, so I've still had a lot of growing up to do and lessons to learn, you know, up into including today. So just that little tidbit. But anyways, going back, so I was working at a bar, hanging out with all these, like, older guys, and that was a big thing for me, was constantly seeking the attention of, you know, men and just anything to chase excitement and to feel better, you know. And so I wound up, I was going out with these guys, you know, and I would go to their house, and they'd be tattooing each other in the kitchen. Like, I mean, every other week someone would get locked up. I mean, these were not, like, good people to be hanging around, but these are, like, the lower companions I sought because they did not question me when I was drinking. You know, a lot of my friends would be like, how much did you drink today? Or, like, what did you mix with your drink? Or, you know, and I just started to realize that the way that I drank wasn't normal. Like, I loved it so much, and when I looked at my peers, they did not feel the same way as me. And, you know, alcohol didn't, I guess, do for them what it does for me. And so, and one day, I mean, this was way back when, but caller ID had just come out, and my mom was really big on saying, like, call me when you get there from the home phone. And because I would tell her I'm going over for a slumber party for popcorn and movies with my girlfriends, but that was never the case. And so she would be like, call me from the home phone. So I worked this, like, elaborate lie and really went out to a party with all these, like, 20-year-old guys or whatever. And my grandfather died in the middle of the night. And so my mom called my girlfriend's house looking for me to tell me to come home and to deal with things with my grandfather, and they couldn't find me. So, so my mom trained German Shepherds, and she had all these canine police friends. So they were looking for me, and they, like, tracked this number, and they went to this guy's house, and it was just, like, a bad scene. And they wound up finding me in the basement of this guy's house, you know, passed out and, like, half clothed and just bottles everywhere. And it was just a really ugly scene to find your, like, you know, 15-year-old daughter like that. So, you know, my parents were starting to be on to me, like, they knew that something was wrong. And they were definitely like, you know, we're so ashamed of you. Like, we were grieving your grandfather, but, like, we couldn't even do that because we were looking for you. Like, how selfish are you? All kinds of stuff. And I wound up getting really, really dark and really, really hopeless. And I really felt like there was no way out. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just knew that life seemed too hard and there was just no way out. So I attempted suicide and wound up going to a psych ward. And when I got to the hospital, you know, what happened was is I kind of had, I went psycho. And at school that day, they had showed us the film Dead Poets Society. And in that movie, this guy named Neil kills himself. So I just wrote Neil like 100 times, like just all over the place. And I have, like, a huge letter N, a scar in my arm from Neil from Dead Poets Society, which is embarrassing. But so, yeah, I just kind of had this, like, psychotic break and wound up going to the psych ward. And my parents, when they got there, I am not even kidding, there was a guy dressed up like a bird squawking in the hallway. And so my parents were like, you know, we were this, like, nice Northern Virginia family or whatever, and they were like, no, you are not staying here. And they were like, our daughter is not crazy, she's just sad. And so they took me out of there and started me in therapy. And, you know, through a weird series of circumstances, I wound up with this lady, and she happened to have, you know, over 20 years sober in AA. And the moment she met me, she just knew, like, it was alcoholism, you know? And she almost didn't really even do a lot of other, like, therapy stuff with me. She was just like, you got to go to AA, you know? And she taught me the Serenity Prayer and just kept giving me AA pamphlets, like, every week. And I actually saw her for 3 years before I wound up going to AA. But, and she just kept saying, I'll never forget, she was like, you'll be ready when you're ready. And I was like, what does that even mean? You know, like, I just didn't get it. And, but she never judged me. I never felt, you know, even though she would bring it up every week, I didn't feel pressured. I didn't feel judged. She just had such a faith in God and a faith in AA that she was like, when you're ready, you'll be ready, you know. And I thought that was so interesting that when I was finally ready and went to my first meeting, you know, I've stayed sober since. So, yeah, so things in my life, you know, were really crumbling, and so I was dropped, you know, I failed out of school. I mean, I was just barely hanging on, barely living. I could stay in my room for weeks on end. I was, and I realize now it's what we call, like, the bondage of self. Like, I would wake up with such impending doom and fear that I literally could not leave my house unless there was a promise of alcohol on the horizon. And some days just even knowing that it was waiting for me would be enough to give me relief to get out of bed. And, you know, and so I was drinking with friends. I mean, the guy who I snuck out with the night my grandfather died, we were out partying, and he dropped me off and on the way home hit a tree and died. And so there were things like that. You know, other guys, you know, were going to jail. And I just, all around me was just, like, losers, but it was, like, my time was coming, and I knew it was only a matter of time. And all this time, you know, I was still working at this bar, and I just had access to unlimited amounts of alcohol. You know, my parents did the best they could, but I just was a hellion, and my sister, you know, always was helping me with getting messed up and whatever. So finally, for me, I really did try, like, to fix myself. I tried to fix myself, like, 100 times. Like, okay, like, if only I can change schools, then I'll be happy. It's the school that's bad, you know? So they went through this whole thing trying to transfer me. Like, if only, like, I lost some weight, then I'll be happy, you know? Or if I get a new boyfriend, or if I get a new wardrobe, or, you know, I always wanted a fresh start because my world would crumble and, you know, all eyes would be on me and I'd be just like, I just need a fresh start. Like, I need a do-over. And but I always needed a do-over. And there's a speaker I really like named Larry T in California, and he says, like, do-overs are the only things that give losers like me hope. Because that was just my big thing, just like, everyone get off my case, you know. And I would throw, like, a hysterical tantrum if my mom was like, why don't you help out every now and then? Like, why don't you empty the dishwasher? And I'd be like, I can't do it. You know, just the simplest, like, life tasks seemed insurmountable. And so, I mean, that's the kind of hell I was living in. And so finally for me, like, I tried this new diet and I was doing better, so it seemed, for a little while, seeing this therapist and just trying, you know. And you know, too, like, drugs were, like, a big part of my story, but I'm just not talking about that just because I'm trying to focus on our primary purpose, our singleness of purpose. But there was a lot of that, too. But so it was Christmas Eve 2000, and I had decided, my therapist was like, just try not drinking for, like, a month. Like, just give it a whirl, you know, because I would always say, like, I'm not powerless over alcohol. I just changed my mind, you know? And, like, I would wake up with the conviction, like, today I'm going to be a winner. Like, today I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to do these things. And I would write myself notes and be like, remember, you're swearing that you're not going to drink today. Like, no matter what your head says, like, don't believe it. And every day I'd wake up and fail. You know, like, if a drink crossed my path, I was completely powerless. I was drinking it before I even realized, you know. There was no pause between me and that drink. And I was lying. I mean, I always say, like, double, quadruple, triple, you know, all these different lies. There was not a human being on this planet who knew the truth about me, the whole truth. Because, like I said, I mean, I would tell one lie to someone else, and I had just lies and webs everywhere. Constantly paranoid, constantly backstabbing and gossiping about the girls in my life, you know, my friends, stealing, feeling ashamed. I mean, I just dug myself this ditch. So I had no choice but to drink, because drinking was the only thing that gave me relief from the way that I was living. And so Christmas Eve, I got into a huge fight with my mom, and because they got me a stereo for Christmas, and I didn't want a stereo. So that's, like, how bratty and selfish I was. And so they all went to bed, and, you know, I hadn't drank in a month. And was just, I was doing drugs, but I wasn't drinking, because drinking had calories in it, and I was on a diet. So so that was, like, my thinking. But so these older guys from the bar, you know, texted me, and I snuck out and, like, went out with them. And, you know, wound up showing off. I mean, because I had an extremely high tolerance. Like, I would drink with, you know, college football players, and one of them would pass out, and then another one would come to the table. And, you know, I mean, I really just took to alcohol very strongly. Like, I just could really drink a lot. And so I just started showing off, drinking with these guys, and all of a sudden I blacked out. And I usually, up to that point, hadn't been blacking out a lot. So the next day, you know, I woke up, was shaken awake by my father. Christmas, it was Christmas afternoon, and I had, like, leaves in my hair and mascara all over my face, and I was, like, wearing someone else's clothes, and I had missed Christmas, you know. And so, yeah, and basically, you know, as a young girl, you know, running around, I went out with all these older guys, and, you know, bad things happened, and I had no intention of any of those things happening. You know, I came to, like, remembering some things that had happened, it was just a really bad, bad scene. And so I just looked at myself in the mirror and was just like, how did it, like, get to this? Like, I'm doing the best that I can. Like, and that's the thing, like, I never set out to just be a loser, you know? Like, I always, like, tried so hard to, like, do the best I could, and, like, and I was just so powerless. Like, alcohol, like, had me by the throat. Like, I just lived to drink, because that's the only thing that could make me feel better, you know? And all I wanted was some relief. I didn't want all these bad things to happen, but I just had to drink, you know? And so, you know, my parents cleaned me up, and, like, I had a black eye, and they put, like, a Santa Claus hat over my eye so that they could take family pictures on Christmas. And it was just the worst, you know. And so I knew that I had to change, and I didn't know. I really got to the point where I couldn't imagine life continuing to drink the way that I was, because I knew I was going to die, or, like, someone was going to kill me, or, you know, something was going to, I was going to overdose, like, something would happen. But I had no idea. Like, if you said live without drinking, that was just a blank spot. I could not picture what life was like, you know. I actually didn't even know when I first came to AA that people in AA don't drink at all. Like, I never met a person on the planet who didn't drink at all. So I was like, oh, you mean you just don't drink, like, on the weekends? Or you, like, I didn't even know that people were, like, sober. So anyway, I mean, yeah, so I was at that jumping off point that our book talks about, like, I can't imagine life with or without it. And I was between a rock and a hard place, nowhere to go. And I continued drinking for about another week. And my therapist had given me the number of another girl in AA who was my age. And I tried calling her a bunch of times. And finally, you know, we connected, and she took me to my first meeting in Virginia. It's called Up the Tubes in McLean. And that night, you know, I just remember walking in, and I judged everyone for, like, what they were wearing. Like, someone had, like, a Christmas sweater on or something, and I was just like, I'm too cool for this. Like, and but then I heard people share, and now I know that it's the language of the heart, because people just spoke the truth. And for the first time, I heard other people, and for the first time, I related, you know, because I actually thought, like, I might be an alien. Like, I thought, like, I'm from outer space, because I could just not fit in the world around me. There was something fundamentally wrong with me, and no one knew what that was. And when I came to AA, I just, like, lit up and was just like, maybe, just maybe, these people know where I've been and know a way out. Like, maybe, just maybe, they can help me today, you know, to stop drinking. And it seemed like not only had they stopped drinking, but they were actually at peace with themselves and comfortable in their skin and happy. And I had no capacity for that. I had, you know, all I knew was fear, anxiety, loneliness, self-pity. I mean, those were, like, my daily, that was, like, the setting I was on every day. And like I said, my first night, everyone's like, get a sponsor. And, you know, I'd played sports my whole life, so I was like, all right, I know about sponsors. So I was, like, looking for someone who had the most money or looked like they did because, you know, she could sponsor me. And I just, like, grabbed this random girl and didn't even know, like, what was going on. And she was like, okay, read this chapter in the big book, and this is a big book, and she gave it to me. And she was like, write your sobriety date in there with pen because, you know, you don't want to erase it. Like, write it in there with pen and, like, put your name on there. And so I was just like, all right. And so I did, you know. And I just slowly but surely started just doing the things that people suggested. And thankfully, I was in a group. Like, I wound up in a group where people carried the newcomers, or, like, they carried me, you know. I drove, and I lived really far away, so they didn't pick me up all the time, but I would drive, like, to their house, and then we'd drive, like, to other meetings and pick up three or four girls. And, you know, I had plans every day from then out. And the biggest thing, I mean, I just remember, like, when I was new, people would, like, remember my name and look me in the eye and shake my hand. And I had never felt that kind of, like, dignity before, or, like, love, you know. And because, like, one time, I guess I had, like, a week sober, and my cat went missing, and, you know, she just got out or something and was gone for, like, a week. And I remember we found her, and I, like, went to school and told my friends, or, like, my drinking friends, like, oh my god, my cat's, we found her. And they were like, so, like, we didn't even know she's missing. Like, and I had told them. And then that night I went to the meeting, and I got there, and someone was like, hey, did you find your cat? How's that going? And I was just like, you know, these people have known me a couple of days, and they took more of an interest in me than my friends that I had had for years, you know. And I mean, that's 13 years ago, and I can pinpoint, like, every act of kindness like that, that just gave me hope each day, that, like, built me up, you know, and showed me, like, the principles of this program. And, you know, like, when I had, so, like, when I had 2 months sober, I had a birthday, and I was just such, like, a pain, like, a sore spot in my family, like, not one person said happy birthday, you know, like, it was just too hard, like, I had just burned too many bridges, and, you know, none of my old friends at school really said anything or cared, you know, or, and I got to the meeting, and they're like, it's Katie's birthday, you know, and they took me out to a diner, and everyone, like, emptied their pockets and gave me presents, you know, I got, like, pocket change and, like, paper clips and, like, tampons or something, you know. And they bought me, like, cake. And I just was, like, so happy. Like, I mean, it just showed me, like, just love, you know. And now I try to remember those things when I go to meetings, you know, for newcomers or just other people. They don't even have to be new, but just, like, if I can remember to ask somebody about something they're going through or, you know, their birthday or something, because those things meant so much to me. So, like, maybe that can, like, help somebody else too, you know. And so as I stayed sober, you know, I went through a lot of adventures, and I was, you know, I stayed so close to the fellowship because, I mean, I was 16 when I got sober. And so, like, I had to finish high school sober. And that meant, like, separating from a lot of my, like, you know, bad friends or whatever. And, you know, there were a lot of days where I had to eat lunch by myself, you know, and, you know, walk the halls. Like, but, you know, people in AA would be like, just before you walk into school, like, visualize you're walking into a meeting and, like, we're all there with you. And so, like, those kinds of things, like, I would just go all day, like, waiting to get to the meeting because that's what gave me hope. And, you know, and to be honest, like, I still really struggled with showing up for school. Like, even when I got sober, I would stay out all night with sober people and not go to school. But you know, I stayed sober, and, you know, and I tried to get better. You know, I was trying to live by principle, and I did start working the steps. And that was an interesting adventure, too, you know. My sponsor at the time, he said, you know, before you speak, like, someone asked me to speak for them for their anniversary, and he's like, before you speak, you have to do your fourth and fifth step so you know, like, your story. And so I was scheduled to speak. It was September 13th, and that was 2001. So September 11th happened, and I was like, oh, God, I got to do my fifth step. Like, you know, it was just crazy. And my mom wound up reading my four-step by accident. I left it on the kitchen table, so that caused, like, so much pain and, like, family drama. And but, you know, I got my fourth and fifth step done. And for me, that one was just really about weeding through all my lies, because I still, like, my first instinct would just be to lie. Like, even in AA, I would exaggerate stuff all the time, or, like, downplay the really bad stuff, and I just had such a hard time just saying the plain truth, you know, and just being myself. I still wanted to be the chameleon. I still wanted approval constantly. And so I worked the steps, and I mean, fellowshipping and hanging out was, like, a huge part of my sobriety. And, you know, looking back, I think, you know, God works in our lives in mysterious ways. And I think just for me, like, I wound up at the right group at the right time for me and did the things that, you know, enabled me to stay sober. And that literally meant, like, going to meetings every single day and talking to my sponsor every day and having three or four service positions and just really being inundated with AA. Because for a while, I really wasn't equipped to be, like, in the real world, you know, and but I learned, you know, and I've thought about that recently because there are just little things, like, I learned how to make the coffee, you know, and, like, someone was like, you need to mop the floor, and I was like, I don't even mop the floor at my own house, like, why would I do it here? And, but that was just it, you know, like, I just learned how to contribute, because my whole life, when I'd walk into a room, my first instinct would just be, what can I take? You know, like, what guy is cute? Like, who can I get attention from? You know, like, what can I steal? What can I take? You know, how can I make this about me? And so AA really started to teach me through showing up at meetings and through doing service a different way. So yeah, I learned how to make the coffee. And, you know, when I have, you know, maybe a year sober or so, my mom entered our dog into a dog show, and I showed up for her, which I had never done. You know, it had always been like, she needs to be here for me. Like, it never occurred to me to show up and contribute to my mom's interests, you know. And they were at the concession stand, and the coffee pot broke, so they needed to use, like, one of the big ones that we usually use at meetings. And they were like, we don't know what to do. We need coffee. And I was like, I know what to do. And so, and my mom was just like, oh, my God. And I could just tell that she was, like, kind of, like, proud of me or, like, impressed. And she could be like, yeah, that's my daughter, you know, to, like, her dog show friends or whatever. And so, like, that type of thing, like, you don't always connect those things. But, like, that was just one more brick building up my self-esteem, feeling more like a human and feeling more of, like, one of God's kids, like, just right size in this world. And those types of things I need, you know. So it's been, like, brick by brick, you know, building up my character and my spirit. And, you know, another thing, I started taking meetings into detoxes and psych wards a lot. And I really love that because I really just feel like I'm a psych ward person, you know. Like, I just always relate to them. I just get a warm, fuzzy feeling. And I can talk to them. I have that language of the heart with them. And so, you know, I was balking on one of my amends, and I would go to this detox, like, every Sunday, and it was, like, next door to my grandmother's nursing home, and I was still, like, so afraid to see her, and, you know, I was like, it just makes me uncomfortable when I see her, like, I don't like to see her that way, because she had Alzheimer's, and so, but I just kept going to my detox commitment every week, so finally it just wore on me enough that, you know, after the detox, I pulled into a retirement home. And, you know, I think I was about 18 at that time. So I started just every Sunday going to the detox and going to visit my grandmother. But, you know, Alzheimer's patients, that's really hard to deal with, you know. And I learned how to deal with crazy people, so it helped me to learn how to deal with her, you know, like, just to, like, laugh it off or, like, have patience or just how to stay calm. I mean, just, like, little things. And that also was one of those things that just, like, built up my spirit. You know, that was one of the first amends that I made. And it wasn't, like, I could just say, hey, Nana, like, sorry for all that, like, because she couldn't remember. So I had to just, like, consistently show up for her. And I did until she died, you know. And I was, like, the first person there when she died. And I spoke at her funeral. And people from AA were there. And that's just, like, the kind of thing, like, I just didn't have, like, the capacity for that kind of thing. Like I said, I mean, I would straight up ruin events. Like, if I started to feel like it wasn't about me or I was out of control, I would, like, threaten to kill myself in the bathroom or, like, run away and hide. I mean, I did that as a teenager. I did that as a two-year-old. You know, like, I was at a wedding and the bride cut in to dance with my dad. And I ran down the highway and left the wedding. And, you know, so it's like I have some kind of weird impulse in me that's just like, if it's not about me, like chaos, you know. And so for me to be like a young woman who can pull it together to speak at a funeral and be appropriate and show up and help people was just amazing to me. And but I couldn't have done that without being sober. And so, and for me, too, like, as I said, you know, I was really involved in the fellowship and, like, all these meetings and all this stuff, but I'm so grateful for my sponsor early on because he also encouraged me to continue growing and seeking and following my heart and really building a connection with God. And so for me, my biggest dream in life when I got sober was to work at Disney World. So he was like, well, you go and be the best Cinderella you can be. And that was like our joke or whatever. So I went to college. Like, that was also an amazing thing. I got into college. Couldn't believe that. My mom actually had to fill out the application because I was so terrified I couldn't turn it in. But I got into college, and then I got into an internship at Disney World. And when I had about 2 years sober, I moved to Florida and lived in Orlando for 6 months. And so for me, I mean, that was really scary. Like I said, you know, I would live weeks at a time, locked in the house, afraid of everything and everyone. I couldn't drive like on the Beltway. I was afraid. I really hated riding in elevators. I mean, my world got so small. And so for me to move away from my home group, my sponsor, you know, my friends, my boyfriend, my family, this was like a really big deal for me. And I went and I was like, you know what? I got lucky in my home group. I made some friends. But when I get to Florida, no one's going to like me. I'm just going to, you know, lose my mind. And what happened was, is I dove in, and I used the tools that I was taught, and it worked. I stayed sober, and I developed, you know, a fellowship of friends around me, and I was of service, you know, and I got involved in a jail meeting. And for some reason, I don't really know why, but, like, and not even in, like, a dating or weird way, but, like, men have been attracted to me for help ever since I was new. I don't know. Like, I know we don't always, like, mix men and women or whatever, but I just try to be of service if someone needs help. But so I, like, took meetings to this boys, like, maximum security jail. And they, like, worked the steps. Most of them had, like, life sentences after they turned 18 because they were in there for, like, murder and really bad crimes. So it was, like, really heartbreaking to work with them because I actually saw the light come on in their eyes, and they really did have a spiritual awakening, and they changed. But I knew, like, even though they changed, they were still going to spend their life in jail. But I could also see that with these principles, like, even though they were locked up, they could be free. And that was just a really profound experience for me that, you know, I thought the magic was going to be at Disney World, but it was really, like, in the ghetto at this, like, prison. So, yeah, and, you know, I still have a friend named Lana. She had a year sober when I went there. And she, you know, we call each other at Christmas, and we're still friends, and she's still sober today. And so that just, like, really expanded my world and my relationship with God, you know. And I came back, and I finished college, and I wound up pursuing a degree in theater because I'd always, like, wanted to be an actress, but my self-centeredness and fear, you know, it's really hard to perform if you can't even, like, show up or, like, get in front of people. So, you know, I was able to do that. And I always laugh because, you know, in high school I did plays, in college I did plays. And, like, when a whole AA group, like, comes to cheer for you at the play, that's kind of like a weird mix of people. So they're like, my friends would be like, who are all those people? Like, how do you know them? You know? But it was cool. And so I graduated, and I tried to be a professional actress for a while, and, you know, some cool things happened, but I felt like there was something more, you know. And so in 2010, I got laid off, actually, from my day job, and I didn't know. I just felt like, oh, I'm so scared. And what wound up happening, it seems like a blur now, but I got rid of my expensive apartment. I couch hopped with people in AA for about 2 months. And then I flew to East Africa by myself and decided to do that. And, you know, I just had this calling to go there and try to help kids and use, like, my performing artistry. Like, I do music, dance, and drama, like, with kids, you know, orphans or children affected by war. And so I went there, and that really changed my life a lot. I think last time I spoke here was, like, soon after my first trip there, and I've been back 4 times since then. And this December I went, and I actually got engaged to a guy who lives there. And so, yeah, my life has really changed, and it's so weird because, you know, I don't know a ton of people, like, who maybe have that exact same experience. But what I've learned in AA is that I have to do what's in front of me, and I have to try to seek God's will, you know, and the path is laid out before me. So, you know, I say the prayers, you know, like, God, please give me knowledge of your will for me and the power to carry that out, you know, and this just so happens to be my path. And, you know, I got really involved in AA in Uganda. And, again, you know, my parents live in Woodstock, Virginia, and most of the meetings there are some more women these days, but sometimes I would go and it would be me and, like, 10 farmers or something, like, having a meeting. And, like, in Uganda, in Uganda, it would be me and, like, 10 Ugandan guys, like, having a meeting. So I've just kind of had to get over the fact, you know, like, I don't know. It's a fellowship of men and women. So, so I went to Uganda, and I just had really cool experiences because I had come from such, like, structured AA that it was just terrifying to think, like, well, I can't call my friends when I want to. You know, I can't just hang out at the diner every night. I can't even get to a meeting every day. Like, I would have to take a bus 5 hours to get to the meeting, and there would be, like, chickens on my lap and, like, you know, just insanity. I talk about going at any length. Like, I kind of have a new understanding of that because that was a tough time. So, but I would show up at the meetings and try to carry the principles of AA with me, and I listened to speaker CDs. And I really started reading the book, like, thinking about Bill and Bob, and, like, you know, they didn't have the privilege of having a whole meeting list to go to, you know? They really had to live this program every day. And, like, what does that mean? Like, what are those principles, you know? And so I really just tried to connect with my higher power and share love and service around me, you know? And because there's that responsibility statement, like, I am responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. Like, I want the hand of AA to always be there. And so the children I work with, like, they don't know that AA is, like, working with them, you know? Or it's just, like, it's after having had a spiritual awakening, you know, that's what enables me to go out and be of service, and it's as a result of these steps. And so now, like, last year, honestly, was the best year of my life. I did a lot of work. I did a lot of seeking. I got a new job. I was able to travel. You know, Lydia and I spent a week in silent meditation with a Zen Buddhist master in Mississippi. I mean, just wild stuff. Like, how did I get here, you know? But it's from continuing to try to put AA first. My life has just expanded. And but when I got back, and so the day when I left to fly to Uganda, I found out that I got into a grad school program for documentary filmmaking, and I got a scholarship. So I was, like, literally running to the terminal, like, oh my God, because I've applied to grad school for 4 years and, like, never got in. So this was a really big deal to me. But, you know, the past 6 months, I got into school, but I didn't know what that would mean. And my program is one of, like, the top programs in the country, and it really demands that you do it full time. But I actually have a demanding full-time job on top of that. And I have a full-time AA life and full-time family. And, like, so I literally was just running around trying to be all things to all people and do it all. And if you told me to slow down, I'd be like, maybe that's for you, but I can do it, you know, because I have a good program and I know what I'm doing or whatever. Like, maybe I wouldn't outright say that, but that's what I was thinking. And in March, you know, I started having, like, panic attacks every day. I was losing it. And I wound up going to the hospital. I almost had a heart attack. And I just felt so humbled. I was laying there, like, strapped with all these, like, IVs and stuff in the hospital. And I was like, I'm 30 years old. Like, this isn't right. Like, again, how did I get here? Like, my way is not working, you know, and it was, like, really upsetting at the time. I felt so confused. Like, I thought I was doing all the right things, and I just felt so humbled. Like, and so I had to stop acting like I know everything and let go of my arrogance and ego and my old ideas and really listen to what my sponsor said, you know. And she was like, you know, you spent all this time in Africa, and right now, like, that might be what you have to do. You might have to go in Africa mode, you know, and maybe you can only get to one or two meetings a week. And at first I was just like, no. But I did it, and, you know, my health has gotten so much better, and my peace of mind has gotten so much better. And I'm starting to feel, like, the resistance I was feeling to this new change, like, it's just starting to feel like I don't have to worry so much, like, that I'm taken care of. And, you know, and I did move, I moved to, like, the east side of D.C., and I guess I just had fears or judgments. I mean, when I go, like, I'm the only, like, Caucasian person at the meeting. Most people have 30, 40 years sober, so I'm a lot younger than everybody. But, you know, I thought back to my other experiences, and it's just, like, if you want to feel a part of an AA, it really helps to get a service position and, you know, to show up. So I was like, well, I did that before. Maybe I can do it here. And so I got service. And then, like, right when I did that, I just felt so much love for these people, and they love me. And I have my place there. I have my seat. And they light up when I come. And, you know, and there are a lot of guys there. We have a bus that comes from Salvation Army. And I noticed that when we were doing the readings, like, almost no one can read, which was a really big shock to me because it's something I take for granted. Like, I just learned to read at a young age. And so all these guys, like, can't read. And this one guy was like, you know, I'll admit I can't read. Like, would you mind helping me practice? So I just, like, try to get to the meeting a little bit early. And we practice reading the 12 and 12 so that when it's their time to read, they can remember the difficult words. And so, again, it's like I would rather, in my mind, sponsor, like, a parade of cute, like, female pigeons or whatever. But for some reason, my higher power has me reading the 12 and 12 with guys from Salvation Army. I don't know. So, but I'm just like, I'm just trying to be of service. Like, I don't really know. So, but, and I felt that, like, recharge, like, because for me, I really need to show up to meetings so I can hear the newcomers and remember what it's like. But for me, this new experience has been listening to people with 40 years sober and hearing, like, it's still important for me to do this. It's still worth it. I love AA. I'm happy. Like, that's given me, like, a renewed hope, too. And also, it's helped me because a lot of them were, like, Skid Row bums. And so if we can share, like, the language of the heart, and I'm just, like, this girl from Centerville, like, that must mean that I'm probably pretty sick, too, you know? So it's just been a new experience. Like, spending so much time with these old-timers has, like, really given me a new perspective. And it helps me feel smaller and right-sized because at my group, like, I grew up going to the Midtown group. Like, now at this point, I have, you know, 13 and a half years sober. And in the group, like, probably the majority of people have less time than me. So it's just important to have, like, one hand with a newcomer and one hand with someone with more time so I can stay in the middle, you know? Like, if I run around thinking, like, I'm the wisest, smartest, you know, AA, that's just, like, not a good place for me to be. So, so I don't know, this past year definitely changed a lot of things. I never thought I would be going to these different meetings. I never thought, you know, my schedule would change like it has. You know, I'm about to graduate in July from my program. And while it's been really, really hard, I also try to remember to be really grateful. Because, like, you know, when it's over, like, I've built really great friendships with the people in my program. And it's not going to be the same anymore, you know. Like, we're not going to see each other. And just the way that it unfolded, like, I just, one day, like, Lydia and I and a couple friends went to see a documentary. And when we were, like, watching the credits or something, I was like, Lydia, something's happening to me. I was like, it's my destiny calling. And, I mean, that's how I talk. I'm kind of out there. But I, like, ran home, Googled it, and found this program, applied, and then, like, got in, and then it's paid for. Like, I just kept saying yes, and, like, it just rolled so fast. So it's just, like, even though it's been so hard, like, so hard, if I had known how hard it would be, I probably would have never done it. But it's, like, I feel like there has to be, like, God in it because of the way things have worked out. And I think the biggest thing is, like, when it's really hard, it's just, like, you're not through it yet, you know? Like, through every speed bump or setback or, like, terrible time in my sobriety, and I've had, like, a lot of different ups and downs for various reasons. Something good has always come from it. You know, even our drinking stories, which are so dark or so painful, like, are one of our greatest assets today that we can share to help somebody else. So it is my experience that if I stay sober, I'm always taken care of, and that there is a loving higher power, and that with time, you know, with time, and then looking back in retrospect, things always work out for a reason. So I think I'm about out of time, but I just am really grateful to be here today, and I think just being able to get out, I mean, that's one of the greatest things I've felt traveling or just being open to go to new meetings. It's just such a great experience because it's amazing the language of the heart that we do have, you know, whether you're from the same state or country or whatever, like just being open to other people and open to sharing this program, you know, carrying the message wherever we go. And so I love AA road trips and all that. And so it's just an honor to be asked to speak, and I'm really grateful for that. So thank you all for listening. Thanks very much.